The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated August 14, 2023. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Our 100th year is in the page-turning thumbprint area of the upper right corner of the front cover. Time, in large block lettering, is whitish, actually more gray, on a very dark background that supports the portrait of Senator John Fetterman, either bald or a shaved head with neat facial hair. He has blue eyes. He's looking askance from the lens, neither smiling nor frowning, a rather neutral expression on his face. That was our lead article last week. Beginning now with the subtitle World, AI, by the people, for the people. The workers making AI possible rarely see its rewards. One Indian startup is trying to do things differently. This is by Billy Perigo, Karnataka, India. In the shade of a coconut palm, Chandrika tilts her smartphone screen to avoid the sun's glare. It is early morning in Alahalli village in the southern Indian state of Karnataka, but the heat and the humidity are rising fast. There are photos here of four workers in two different photos, including Rajeshwari N., who's wearing pink and is sitting on a wooden stool in front of a computer screen. Chandrika is featured in the second photo. She's wearing mostly yellow, the long pajama-like garment overlaid with a bright yellow apron-like garment. Behind her are two male counterparts, and they are showing handheld devices which display screens on them. They are seated mostly on the gnarled trunk of a very large tree, whereas the first pink-clad woman in the first photograph is apparently in an indoor location. As Chandrika scrolls, she clicks on several audio clips in succession, demonstrating the simplicity of the app she recently started using. At each tap, the sound of her voice speaking her mother tongue emerges through the phone. Before she started using this app, 30-year-old Chandrika, who, like many South Indians, uses the first letter of her father's name, K, instead of a last name, had just 2.25 in her bank account. But in return for around 6 hours of work spread over several days in late April, she received 2,570 rupees, $31.30. That is roughly the same amount she makes in a month of working as a teacher at a distant school. After the cost of the three buses, it takes her to get there and back. Unlike her day job, the app does not make her wait until at the end of the month for payment. Money lands in her bank account in just a few hours. Just by reading text aloud in her native language of Kannada, spoken by around 60 million people, mostly in central and southern India, Chandrika has used this app to earn an hourly wage of about $5, nearly 20 times the Indian minimum. And in a few days, more money will arrive, a 50% bonus awarded once the voice clips are validated as accurate. Chandrika's voice can fetch this sum because of the boom in artificial intelligence, AI. Right now, cutting-edge AIs, for example, large language models like ChatGPT, work best in languages like English, where text and audio data are abundant online. They work much less well in languages like Kannada, K-A-N-N-A-D-A, which even though it is spoken by millions, is scarce on the Internet. Wikipedia has 6 million articles in English, for example, but only 30,000 in Kannada. When they function at all, AIs in these lower resource languages can be biased by assuming doctors are men and nurses women, for example, and can struggle to understand local dialects. To create an effective English-speaking AI, it is enough to simply collect data from where it has already accumulated. But for languages like Kannada, you need to go out and find more. This has created huge demand for data sets, collections of text or voice data, in languages spoken by some of the poorest people in the world. Part of that demand comes from tech companies seeking to build out AI tools. Another big chunk comes from academia and governments, especially in India, where English and Hindi have long held outsized precedence in a nation of some 1.4 billion people with 22 official languages and at least 780 more indigenous ones. This rising demand means hundreds of millions of Indians suddenly possess a scarce and newly valuable asset, their mother tongue. Data work, creating or refining the raw material at the heart of AI, is not new in India. The economy that did so much to turn call centers and garment factories into engines of productivity in the late 20th century has quietly been doing the same with data work in the 21st. And like its predecessors, the industry is once again dominated by labor arbitrage companies, which pay wages close to the legal minimum while selling data to foreign clients for a hefty markup. The AI data sector, worth over $2 billion globally in 2022, is projected to rise to $17 billion by 2030. Little of that money has flowed down to data workers in India, Kenya, and the Philippines. These conditions may cause harms far beyond the lives of individual workers. We are talking about systems that are impacting our whole society, and workers who make those systems more reliable and less biased, says Jonas Valente, an expert in digital work platforms at Oxford University's Internet Institute. If you have workers with basic rights who are more empowered, I believe that the outcome, the technological system, will have a better quality as well. In the neighboring villages of Alahali and Chulukuvadi, one Indian startup is testing a new model. Chandrika works for Karya, K-A-R-Y-A, a nonprofit launched in 2021 in Bengaluru, formerly Bangalore, that bills itself as the world's first ethical data company. Like its competitors, it sells data to big tech companies and other clients at the market rate, but instead of keeping much of that cash as profit, it covers its costs and funnels the rest toward the rural poor in India. In addition to its $5 hourly minimum, Karya gives workers de facto ownership of the data they create on the job. So whenever it's resold, the workers receive the proceeds on top of their past wages. It is a model that does not exist anywhere else in the industry. The wages that exist right now are a failure of the market. Manu Chopra, the 27-year-old CEO of Karya, tells me, "We decided to be a nonprofit because fundamentally you cannot solve a market failure in the market. The work Karya is doing also means millions of people whose languages are marginalized online could stand to gain better access to the benefits of technology, including AI. Most people in the villages do not know English," says Vinutha, a 23-year-old student who has used Karya to reduce her financial reliance on her parents. "If a computer could understand Kannada, that would be very helpful." The catch, if you can call it that, is that the work is supplementary. The first thing Karya tells its workers is, this is not a permanent job, but rather a way to quickly get an income boost that will allow you to go on and do other things. The maximum a worker can earn through the app is the equivalent of $1,500, roughly the average annual income in India. After that point, they make way for somebody else. Karya says it's paid out 65 million rupees, nearly $800,000, in wages to some 30,000 rural Indians up and down the country. By 2030, Chopra wants to reach 100 million people. "I genuinely feel this is the quickest way to move millions of people out of poverty, if done right," says Chopra, who was born into poverty himself. "This is absolutely a social project. Wealth is power, and we want to redistribute wealth to the communities who have been left behind." Chopra is not the first tech founder to rhapsodize about the potential of AI data work to benefit the world's poorest. Sama, S-A-M-A, an outsourcing company that has handled contracts for OpenAI's ChatGPT and Meta's Facebook, also marketed itself as an ethical way for tech companies to lift people in the global south out of poverty. But as I reported in January, many of its ChatGPT workers in Kenya, some earning less than $2 per hour, told me they were exposed to training data that left them traumatized. The company also performed similar content moderation work for Facebook. One worker on that project told me he was fired when he campaigned for better working conditions. When asked by the BBC in 2018 about low wages, Sama's late founder argued paying workers higher wages could disrupt local economies, causing more harm than good. Many of the data workers I have spoken to while covering this industry for the past 18 months have bristled at this logic, saying it is a convenient narrative for companies getting rich off the proceeds of their labor. "There's another way," Chopra argues. "The biggest lesson I've learned over the last 5 years is that all of this is possible." He wrote in a series of tweets in response to my January article on ChatGPT, "We can pay our workers 20 times minimum wage and still be a sustainable organization." It was the first I had heard of Karya, and my immediate instinct was skepticism. Sama had begun its life as a nonprofit, focused on poverty eradication, only to transition later to a for-profit business. Could Karya really be a model for a more inclusive and ethical AI industry? Even if it were, could it scale? One thing was clear: there could be few better testing grounds for these questions than India. a country where mobile data is among the cheapest in the world, and where it's common for even poor rural villagers to have access to both a smartphone and a bank account, then there's the potential upside. Even before the pandemic, some 140 million people in India survived on under $2.15 per day, according to the World Bank. For those people, cash injections of the magnitude Chopra was talking about could be life-changing. Just 70 miles from the bustling tech metropolis of Bengaluru, past sugarcane fields and under the bright orange arcs of blossoming gulmohar trees, is the village of Chilukavadi. Inside a low concrete building, the headquarters of a local farming cooperative, a dozen men and women are gathered, all of whom have started working for Karya in the past week. Kanakaraj S., a skinny 21-year-old, sits cross-legged on the cool concrete floor. He is studying at a nearby college, and to pay for books and transport costs, he occasionally works as a casual laborer in the surrounding fields. A day's work can earn him 350 rupees, around $4, but this kind of manual labor is becoming more unbearable as climate change makes summers here even more sweltering than usual. Working in a factory in a nearby city would mean a slightly higher wage, but also hours of daily commuting on unreliable and expensive buses, or worse, moving away from his support network to live in dorms in the city. At Karya, Kanakaraj can earn more in an hour than he makes in a day in the fields. The work's good, he says, and easy. Kanakaraj was surprised when he saw the first payment land in his bank account. We've lost a lot of money from scams, he tells me, explaining it's common for villagers to receive SMS texts, preying on their desperation, offering to multiply any deposits they make by 10. When somebody first told him about Karya, he assumed it was a similar con, a common initial response, according to Chopra. With so little in savings, local people often find themselves taking out loans to cover emergency costs. Predatory agencies tend to charge high interest rates on these loans, leaving some villagers here trapped in cycles of debt. Chandrika, for example, will use some of her Karya wages to help her family pay off a large medical loan incurred when her 25-year-old sister fell ill with low blood pressure. Despite the medical treatment, her sister died, leaving the family responsible for both an infant and a mountain of debt. Other Karya workers find themselves in similar situations. Ajay Kumar, 25, is drowning in medical debt, taken out to address his mother's severe back injury. And Shivana N., 38, lost his hand in a firecracker accident as a boy. While he does not have debt, his disability means he struggles to make a living. The work these villagers are doing is part of a new project Karya is rolling out across the state of Karnataka for an Indian healthcare NGO seeking speech data about tuberculosis, a mostly curable and preventable disease that still kills around 200,000 Indians every year. The voice recordings, collected in 10 different dialects of Kannada, will help train an AI speech model to understand local people's questions about tuberculosis and respond with information aimed at reducing the spread of the disease. The hope is that the app, when completed, will make it easier for illiterate people to access reliable information without shouldering the stigma that tuberculosis patients, victims of a contagious disease, often attract when they seek help in small communities. The recordings will also go up for sale on Karya's platform as part of its Kannada dataset on offer to the many AI companies that care less about the contents of their training data than what it encodes about the overall structure of the language. Every time it's resold, 100% of the revenue will be distributed to the Karya workers who contributed to the data set, apportioned by the hours they put in. I think all of us have a keen recognition of the idea that money is a cushion from reality, Chopra says of the Karya team. Our goal is to give that cushion to as many people as possible. Chopra knows firsthand the indignity of poverty. He was born in an informal settlement in Delhi, and although his parents were well-educated and from a dominant caste, they sometimes struggled to put food on the table. Chopra excelled at the local NGO-run school and won scholarships, first to a private high school in Delhi and then to Stanford. Unlike many Silicon Valley rags-to-riches stories, Chopra's trajectory in his telling was not down to his own hard work. "I got lucky 100 times in a row," he says. "I am a product of irrational compassion from nonprofits, from schools, from the government." After graduation, Chopra returned to India and joined Microsoft Research, a subsidiary of the big tech company that encourages researchers to work on difficult social problems. With his colleague Vivek Seshadri, he set out to investigate whether it would be possible to channel money to rural Indians using digital work. In 2021, with a grant from Microsoft Research, the pair quit their jobs to spin Karya out as a nonprofit, joined by a third co-founder, Safiya Hussain. Although small, Karya already has a list of high-profile clients, including MIT, Microsoft, which holds no equity in Karya, and Stanford. In February, Karya began work on a new project for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to build voice data sets in 5 languages spoken by some 1 billion Indians: Marathi, Telugu, Hindi, Bengali, and Malayalam. The end goal is to build a chat bot that can answer rural Indians' questions in their native languages and dialects about healthcare, agriculture, sanitation, banking, and career development. This technology, think of it as a chat GPT for poverty eradication, could help share crucial knowledge across vast swaths of the subcontinent. I think there should be a world where language is no longer a barrier to technology, so everyone can use technology irrespective of the language they speak, says Kalika Bali, a linguist and principal researcher at Microsoft Research, who's working with the Gates Foundation on the project and is an unpaid member of Karya's oversight board. She has specifically designed the prompts workers are given to read aloud to mitigate the gender biases that often creep into data sets and thus help avoid the doctor and nurse problem. But it is not just about the prompts. Karya's relatively high wages percolate down to the quality of the data, Bali says. It will immediately result in better accuracy of the system's output. She says she typically receives data with a less than 1% error rate from Karya, which is almost never the case with data that we build AI models with. Not everybody's eligible to work for Karya. Chopra says initially he and his team opened the app up to anybody, only to realize the first 100 sign-ups were all men from a dominant caste community. The experience taught him that knowledge flows through the channels of power, Chopra says, to reach the poorest communities and marginalized castes genders, and religions, Chopra had to team up with nonprofits with a grassroots presence in rural areas. Those organizations can distribute access codes on Karya's behalf, in line with income and diversity requirements. They know for whom that money is nice to have, and for whom it's life-changing, he says. This process also ensures more diversity in the data that workers end up generating, which can help to minimize AI bias. Chopra defines this approach using a Hindi word, Thairav, T-H-A-I-R-A-A-V, from Indian classical music that he translates as a mixture between pause and thoughtful impact. To him, it means that every step you're pausing and thinking, am I doing the right thing? Is this right for the community I'm trying to serve? It is a concept, he says, that's missing, not only from the English language, but also from a lot of the entrepreneurial, move fast and break things behavior that is typical of Silicon Valley tech companies. It is an approach that has led Karya to flatly reject 4 offers so far from prospective clients to do content moderation that would require workers to view traumatizing material. It is compelling, but it's also coming from a guy who told me he wants to scale his app to reach 100 million Indians by 2030. Doesn't Karya's reliance on grassroots NGOs to onboard every new worker mean it faces a significant bottleneck? Actually, Chopra says, the limiting factor to Karya's expansion is not finding new workers. There are millions who will jump at the chance to earn its high wages, and Karya has built a vetted network of more than 200 grassroots NGOs to onboard them. The bottleneck is the amount of available work. What we need is large-scale awareness that most data companies are unethical, he says, and that there is an ethical way. For the app to have the impact Chopra believes it can, he needs to win more clients, to persuade more tech companies, governments, and academic institutions to get their AI training data from Karya. But it is often in the pursuit of new clients that even companies that pride themselves on ethics can end up compromising. What's to stop Karya doing the same? Part of the answer, Chopra says, lies in Karya's corporate structure. Karya is registered as a nonprofit in the U.S. that controls 2 entities in India, 1 nonprofit and 1 for-profit. The for-profit is legally bound to donate any profits it makes after reimbursing workers to the nonprofit, which reinvests them. The convoluted structure, Chopra says, is because Indian law prevents nonprofits from making any more than 20% of their income from the market, as opposed to philanthropic donations. Karya does take grant funding. Crucially, it covers the salaries of all 24 of its full-time employees, but not enough to make an entirely nonprofit model possible. The arrangement, Chopra says, has the benefit of removing any incentive for Karya's co-founders to compromise on worker wages or well-being in return for lucrative contracts. It is a model that works for the moment, but could collapse if philanthropic funding dries up. Karya is very young, and they have a lot of good traction, says Subhashri Dutta, a managing partner at the Nudge Institute, an incubator that has supported Karya with a $20,000 grant. They have the ability to stay true to their values and still attract capital, but I do not think they've been significantly exposed to the dilemmas of taking the for-profit or not-for-profit stance. Over the course of 2 days with Karya workers in southern Karnataka, the limitations of Karya's current system begin to come into focus. Each worker says they have completed completed 1,287 tasks on the app, the maximum at the point of my visit of the number of tasks available on the tuberculosis project. It equates to about 6 hours of work. The money workers can receive, just under $50 after bonuses for accuracy, is a welcome boost, but won't last long. On my trip, I don't meet any workers who have received royalties. Chopra tells me Caria has only just amassed enough resellable data to be attractive to buyers. It has so far distributed $116,000 in royalties to around 4,000 workers, but the ones I have met are too early into their work to be among them. I put to Chopra that it will still take much more to have a meaningful impact on these villagers' lives. The tuberculosis project is only the beginning for these workers, he replies. They are lined up to shortly begin work on a transcription project, part of a push by the Indian government to build AI models in several regional languages, including Kannada. The project, he says, will allow Caria to give significantly more work to the villagers in Chilukavati. Still, the workers are a long way from the $1,500 that would mark their graduation from Caria's system. Eventually, Chopra acknowledges that not a single one of Caria's 30,000 workers has reached the $1,500 threshold. Yet their enjoyment of the work, their desire for more, is clear. When Vivek Seshradi, Caria's chief technology officer, asks the room full of workers whether they would feel capable of a new task, flagging inaccuracies in Kannada sentences, they erupt in excited chatter. A unanimous yes. The villagers I speak to in Chulakavati and Alahali have only a limited understanding of artificial intelligence. Chopra says this can be a challenge when explaining to workers what they are doing. The most successful approach his team has found is telling workers they are teaching the computer to speak Kannada, he says. Nobody here knows of ChatGPT, but villagers do know that Google Assistant, which they refer to as OK Google, works better when you prompt it in English than in their mother tongue. Sitaraju L., a 35-year-old unemployed father of three, says he does not know what AI is, but would feel proud if a computer could speak his language. The same respect I have for my parents, I have for my mother tongue. Just as India was able to leapfrog the rest of the world on 4G because it was unencumbered by existing mobile data infrastructure, the hope is that efforts like the ones Caria is enabling will help Indian language AI projects learn from the mistake of English AIs and begin from a far more reliable and unbiased starting point. Until not so long ago, a speech recognition engine for English would not even understand my English, says Bali, the speech researcher, referring to her accent. What is the point of AI technologies being out there if they do not cater to the users they are targeting? There's a full-page photograph here in color, all which shows something in the background, stacks and stacks of large bundles. They're not gunny sacks, but they're the plastic equivalent of them, it appears. And in front of the bundles, is seated a man in an armchair, perhaps an office chair. He has a yellow shirt. He is holding a handheld device with its screen app open. He's smiling at the camera. He has very dark hair and very dark facial hair, bright brown eyes. He's seated with a fabric over his legs and lap, It's blue and green and yellow and black. This is Shivana N., 38, who lost his right hand in an accident at the age of 8. His disability has made it hard to find work, so he's holding his device in his left hand. While seated on his lap is a small animal. At first glance, I thought it was a black dog, but no, it is a black goat. It looks very comfortable there. Off to his right is a small vehicle. It looks like a very small bicycle with training wheels, but I believe there are two wheels in the back. It's hard for me to see because they're in the shadow. It's red, and it has a rear view mirror on the handlebars. It looks like something that would be easily accessible for a person moving directly from being seated in a chair to being seated on this probably tricycle contraption. Above the subject, Shivana N., is a metal ceiling, perhaps also the metal roof. The walls are painted in white, and there is one window visible, or a portion of a window, with horizontal bars across it. And there is a fan, a ceiling fan, very noticeable in the photo. This rather lengthy technology-oriented article was written by Billy Perigo, Karnataka, India. From the Time Off segment, the 100 best movies of the past 10 decades. It's a very Art Deco looking illustration with 100 best movies of the past 10 decades in gold against a black background with some kind of beams radiating around the edges as if one were looking at the opening or closing of a vintage black and white movie. Times film critic Stephanie Zakarik selects the top movies from the 1920s through the 2010s. And the illustrations, including this one on the cover of this section, the illustrations are by Jillian Adel for Time. There are more almost replicates of that cover page as we thumb through the pages of the 100 Best Movies. Okay, starting here with an essay by Stephanie Zakarik. If you are like most people, you probably freeze when someone asks you what you think is the best movie of all time. What if you give a confident answer, only to wake up in the middle of the night certain you should have said something else? And do you choose the movie you love most, or one you know is commonly identified as great? After all, if you go with one of the classic default choices, Citizen Kane, Casablanca, The Godfather, no one can accuse you of having bad taste or strange taste or the wrong taste. After compiling and annotating my own list of the 100 best movies of the past century, broken down by decade, 10 pictures in each, I'm here to reassure you that there's no such thing as the wrong taste. And if there is such a thing as bad or strange taste, then my advice is to own it. No one can dictate your preferences to you. They are as individual as your fingerprints. Besides, the issue is further complicated by the fact there are so many barometers of greatness. Is the best movie the one you can watch any time? The one that always lifts your mood? Is it the one that makes you cry the hardest? Is it the one with the actors you never tire of watching? Your decisions about what constitutes greatness will be specific to you. In this case, I'm giving you mine. The internet is full of polls that have divined by soliciting votes from film critics and filmmakers what are ostensibly the greatest movies of all time. This list is not the result of a poll. Aside from the question of whether we really need yet another film survey, there's a way in which choosing by committee irons the idea of loving movies into a smooth, flat sheet, as if the right amount of number crunching will yield the answer. But, as with all individuals, our sensibilities are much more nuanced. There's no such thing as an objective truth when it comes to art. Our movie tastes are determined by some indefinable electrical current of enthusiasm or joy or deep radiating sadness or some combination of the three. In that sense, our favorite movies are not about taste at all, but simply about listening to what really speaks to us. So how did I choose these 100 films? Well, I've spent more than 50 years choosing. These are movies that entwine craftsmanship and spirit. They often feature striking performances. For whatever reason, they touch me deeply, and all speak in some way about the era in which they were made. They are place markers for the things we have seen and the places we have been and the experiences of our forebears, or more accurately, some of our forebears. The unfortunate truth is that through most of the 20th century, the world of filmmaking belonged to white men, at least behind the camera. Women flex their power with great performances, many of which are reflected in this list. There were certainly women filmmakers working in the early part of the century. Alice Guy Blaschet, Dorothy Arzner, Ida Lupino. But until the 60s and 70s, at least, the barriers to entry were high. The same is true for filmmakers of color, particularly in the U.S. Through much of the 20th century, it was easier for black artists to make their mark in music, literature, and painting than in movies. There are exceptions. There was a flowering of so-called race films in the early part of the century, films made specifically for black American audiences. The novelist and filmmaker Oscar Michaud was an early successful pioneer. But it would be decades before filmmakers like Charles Burnett, Melvin Van Peebles, and Julie Dash would find a footing. In that sense, one component of the past 100 years of cinema is a blank space filled with unrealized possibilities. American history is filled with such spaces, and they say a lot about us. Another note about this list, it is marked by what some will see as glaring omissions, including many of those default classics. There's no Citizen Kane, no Casablanca, no Wizard of Oz, no Goodfellas. It is not that I dislike those films, but sometimes the filmmakers behind those pictures have made other movies I love more. I'm thinking of Orson Welles, The Magnificent Ambersons, Michael Curtiz, Mildred Pierce. Great movies that deserve some space in the spotlight. Because this list is broken down by decades, certain patterns emerged, motifs that could not help influencing my choices. For example, any list of great movies might contain a few films, each by Howard Hawks and Alfred Hitchcock, lumped in with all the rest. But scrutinizing each decade also means recontextualizing the filmmakers with the longest careers. The same man who made Scarface in the 1930s had something totally different to say in the late 1950s with Rio Bravo. And some decades filled up astonishingly quickly. The 1950s in particular left many favorites on the cutting room floor. It is almost incomprehensible to me that All About Eve, Tokyo Story, Sunset Boulevard, Gun Crazy, and The Breaking Point are not on this list, but triage was necessary. The days I had to cut films like Alien, Fantastic Mr. Fox, Master and Commander, The Far Side of the World, Cold War, and John Gil Lehrman's 1976 King Kong, which I prefer to the original, were not happy ones. On the plus side, this list includes more comedies than most poll-derived lists do. Comedies are often the also-rans. Everyone wants to be taken seriously, and comedies, even the greatest of them, by the likes of Hawks, Preston Sturgis, or Billy Wilder, are frequently treated as a frivolity, but they often reveal even more of a soul than so-called serious movies do. If movies can be said to have souls, and I think they can, That is why our love for them stretches so wide and deep that no single list, whether made by an individual or group of experts, can contain it. Rather than appease some invisible god of movie objectivity, I'm hoping this list will foster a sense of discovery, adventure, and imagination. Idiosyncrasies are a huge part of what makes us fall in love with other human beings. They're the heart of movie love, too. The wrong taste that's totally right. All right, I'm going to read at least one from each of the decades reviewed by Stephanie Zakaric, and we'll see where that time leaves us. The 1920s, 1924, The Thief of Baghdad by Raoul Walsh. The 1930s, The 39 Steps by Alfred Hitchcock. This was in 1935 with also Top Hat by Mark Sandrich. And the bys, by the way, the bylines are the directors. Moving on now to the 1940s. The Best Years of Our Lives by William Wyler, 1946. The 1950s, The Bandwagon, 1953, by Vincent Minnelli, which I watched over the weekend. Some Like It Hot by Billy Wilder. 1959, Rio Bravo by Howard Hawks, 1959. The 1960s, The Manchurian Candidate, 1962, by John Frankenheimer. Bonnie and Clyde, 1967, Arthur Penn. The 1970s, Young Frankenstein, Mel Brooks, 1974, along with The Godfather Part II, Francis Ford Coppola. The 1980s, well, I don't see any that I, yes I do, I recognize something here. The Right Stuff by Philip Kaufman, 1983, and The Empire Strikes Back, Irvin Kershner, 1980. The 1990s, oh, here's one from 87 to include, Moonstruck by Norman Jewison. 1990s, Malcolm X by Spike Lee in 1992. Carlito's Way, 1993 by Brian De Palma. From the 2000s, here, let's see, what have we got? Mulholland Drive from 2001, David Lynch. The Circle by Jafar Panahi from 2000. From the 2010s, this is the last decade she reviewed. Phoenix by Christian Petzold, 2014. Selma by Ava DuVernay, 2014. Moonlight by Barry Jenkins, 2016. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood by Quentin Tarantino, 2019. Okay, I've got time to go back to the beginning. The 1920s, here's one. Nanook of the North, 1922, by Robert J. Flaherty. There's a description along with this. And is this a 100% unstaged and fully accurate picture of how members of the Inuit population lived in the early 1920s? No. But Flaherty's groundbreaking film strives to capture some sense of their lives for a greater audience. Nanook is luminous, haunting, and joyful, not a documentary, but a document of one man's attempts to see and to help others do so as well. 1930s. Steamboat Bill Jr. from 1920s. Okay, well, Steamboat Bill Jr. from 1928. Charles Reisner and Buster Keaton, how to pick a favorite Keaton film. This is a sturdy choice, Keaton's stunts here, including one in which a storm-battered house falls around him, leaving him miraculously unscathed, were astonishingly dangerous, yet there is so much deadpan joy in them, as if this generally unhappy and somewhat unlucky man had poured his soul into the discipline required to pull them off. All right, now moving ahead to 1930s, Stagecoach, John Ford, 1939, Gone with the Wind, Victor Fleming, 1939, The Rules of the Game, Jean Renoir, 1939. In this I've never heard of, in this glorious tragic comic ensemble escapade set on the eve of World War II, Marcel Dalliot plays a flippant aristocrat obsessed with expensive mechanical novelties. Even so, his feelings for real people take precedence. He fears he's losing his wife, Nora Gregor, to a dashing aviator, Roland Toutain. Renoir's characters are shallow, selfish, and at times nearly unbearable, but he has such deep love for them that by the end of the film, we embrace them too. Here's one she mentioned earlier, 1942, The Magnificent Ambersons by Orson Welles. It is surely an act of cockeyed optimism to love something so flawed. But The Magnificent Ambersons, adapted from Booth Tarkington's novel about the decline of a wealthy Midwestern family, is dappled with such elegiac beauty that its problems hardly matter. The picture was butchered by its studio RKO, but even in its mutilated state, it glistens quietly, almost proudly, as if merely waiting to someday once again be made whole. And in that same list is The Lady Eve, Preston Sturges, 1941. Into the 1950s, I mentioned Rio Bravo and Some Like It Hot, 1959. There's Vertigo, Alfred Hitchcock, 1958. And Imitation of Life, 1959, by Douglas Sirk. Lana Turner and Juanita Moore star as single mothers, one white and one black, who forge a lifelong friendship as they raise their daughters in a racially divided 1950s America. Sirk, a master of big feelings writ large on the screen, minds their complicated dynamic with sensitivity and fearlessness. And while Turner is an undeniably glamorous presence, it is Moore's performance, restrained even amid the movie's grand swirls of emotion, that will stick with you forever. Turning the page to the 1960s. Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock, 1960. I mentioned Bonnie and Clyde, Black Girl by Ousmane Sembene, 1966. 1970s, I mentioned Young Frankenstein from 1974 by Mel Brooks. Brooks and Gene Wilder's co-written riff on the James Whale Frankenstein movies of the 1930s is so exquisite it deserves a special, gloriously cobwebby niche of its own. During filming, with Wilder as the star, the crew kept cracking up, ruining take after take. Brooks distributed 100 white handkerchiefs among them, which they could use to muffle their laughter. The tactic worked. But for the rest of us, resistance is futile. 1980s. Oh, here we are. Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Amy Heckerling, 1982. E.T., The Extraterrestrial, Steven Spielberg, the same year. Blowout, 1981, Brian De Palma. De Palma broke through in the new Hollywood of the 1970s, yet His films have not always gotten the acclaim they deserve. In this vision of a highly untrustworthy America, John Travolta plays a sound guy striving to protect an escort, Nancy Allen, who is embroiled in a political cover-up. The movie's final scene sends you off feeling nothing's right with the world, though it is the opposite of numbness. Rather, it is a sense of being too much alive. The 1990s, I mentioned Moonstruck, 1987, Norman Jewison. Oops, this isn't quite the 90s yet. Oh, well. Moonstruck's appearance in the late 1980s, a dry period for romantic comedies, was a small miracle. Cher plays a 37-year-old widow wooed by an embittered but deeply romantic one-handed baker, Nicolas Cage, who also happens to be the estranged brother of her fiancé, Danny Aiello. To watch these characters figure out the best path for themselves is a particular kind of moonlit bliss. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.